Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Tuesday, October 5th. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Sewell Planning Dealership Complex. The company is looking to replicate its sprawling Odessa complex, by Mella McEwen. The Sewell family of companies is looking to replicate its sprawling Odessa complex of dealerships in Midland on 30.8 acres at State Highway 191 and Avalon Drive. Members of the Planning and Zoning Commission on Monday unanimously approved a request by Lusso Real Estate on behalf of Sewell for initial zoning of the acreage, which is currently being annexed as RR, Regional Retail District. Development plans call for 8 buildings consisting of 3 car dealerships, including a restaurant, as in its Sewell Ford Lincoln dealership in Odessa, 2 service centers, a car wash, an amenities building, and a photo booth building, according to the packet given commissioners. Total square footage of all the buildings would be about 1.34 million square feet. Commissioners also unanimously approved a request by C.G. Faudry, LLC, for a zone change from TP, Technology Park District, to RR, Regional Retail District, on a lot at 1106 West Walcott. The zone change will allow for the development of a Whataburger and Chick-fil-A restaurants. In other action, a request by Black and Dillard Property Management for initial zoning of RR, Regional Retail, at Fairgrounds Road and Garden City Highway was approved to allow for development of an auto and diesel fuel service facility. The site is currently being annexed into city limits. Commissioners approved a request by Preg Development, LLC, for a zone change from PD, Planned District for a Shopping Center, to LR, Local Retail District, at 5509 Andrews Highway, for a future dental office. This article is entitled, Oil Surges to Highest Since 2014. OPEC Sticks to Supply Plan, by Sharon Cho and Alex Longley, Bloomberg. Oil in New York jumped to the highest since 2014 with OPEC Plus's decision to proceed to hike output gradually, surprised some investors who expected a bigger increase in the wake of a shortage of natural gas. U.S. crude futures advanced as much as 3.3% on Monday. OPEC Plus ministers ratified the 400,000-barrel-a-day supply hike scheduled for November after a short video conference on Monday, according to a statement from the group. The decision comes as the world's biggest oil company, Saudi Aramco, said the global natural gas crisis has boosted demand for crude by 500,000 barrels a day. The consensus was that it was going to be an 800,000-barrel-a-day temporary boost in November, said Rob Thummel, a portfolio manager at Tortoise, a firm that manages roughly $8 billion in energy-related assets. The crude market has tightened significantly following the economic recovery from the pandemic and supply disruption in the U.S. Gulf of Mexico due to Hurricane Ida. Surging natural gas prices have also raised the prospect of increased demand for oil products for power generation and are boosting inflationary pressures on the global economy. Modeling from the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and its allies shows oil demand will outstrip supply over the next 2 months. OPEC Plus production policy will be the main factor influencing oil prices over the coming months, according to Vital Group. There's little chance of Iranian barrels returning this year, and U.S. shale producers aren't investing enough to raise output quickly. Mike Muller, head of Asia for the Oil Trading House, said Sunday in a webinar hosted by Dubai-based consultant Gulf Intelligence. OPEC Plus should worry about shortfalls, not surpluses. Fuel switching due to high coal and gas prices likely to drive up oil demand by 500,000 barrels a day this winter, Sri Parivaikarasu, head of Asia Oil at consultant FEG, told Bloomberg Television. A cold winter could see consumption climb by a further 200,000 to 300,000 barrels a day, she added. This article is entitled Lieutenant Governor Patrick to be part of state Senate race, by Stuart Doreen. The complete list of candidates for the District 31 seat in the Texas Senate is not complete. Actually, the district is not set as redistricting is currently taking place. But even if the district that includes Midland, Odessa, and Amarillo doesn't change dramatically, one of the key persons in the Republican nomination process likely will be someone whose name will not appear on the ballot. That person is Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick. Last week, the Republican was in Midland during his comments at the Permian Basin Petroleum Association's annual meeting. He told the oil industry leaders that the Texas Senate, the branch of state government that he oversees, is without adequate representation of any oil men or women. Representative Tom Craddock has been the heart and soul of your industry forever, and thank goodness for Tom. But he's in the House, Patrick said to attendees of the PBPA meeting. We really haven't had a senator who's an oil and gas person, and I think it's important for your industry these days. If not in the industry, then someone who's going to be all for the industry. Interestingly, an oil man from Midland has publicly announced his intention to run for state senate, Kevin Sparks. And noteworthy also is Patrick made the comment knowing that Sparks has announced and that the current occupant of the District 31 seat, Senator Kel Seliger, doesn't have an oil background. But as those in Midland know well, Seliger and Patrick have publicly feuded. Midland-Odessa Transportation Alliance Executive Director James Beecham said the conflict has impacted the region. In January 2019, after Seliger made comments that a Patrick aide could kiss his backside, the Lieutenant Governor not only removed Seliger from his longtime position as chair of the Senate Higher Education Committee, but also off the committee altogether. Patrick also removed Seliger from the Public Education Committee and the Powerful Finance Committee. Seliger currently serves as vice chair of the Senate Transportation Committee and sits on the committees for Health and Human Services, Natural Resources and Economic Development, Veteran Affairs and Border Security, and Nominations. The last 4 years, we have operated without a state senator. That is unfortunate, Beecham told the reporter Telegram, because there are a lot of people out here who could have used one. It would be nice if the District 1 senator was a little bit constituent-oriented, someone we could go to and ask for help. We haven't had that for 4 years. Sparks, during an initial conversation with the reporter Telegram about running for state senate, offered the following about the Patrick Seliger dynamic. Obviously, there are only 31 senators, Sparks said, and so if you're not able to at least work with the person that runs the organization, it does render you somewhat ineffective, because you're constantly swimming upstream. Note, emails to Senator Seliger's campaign office were not returned. This is the local and region page. This article is entitled Arts Council Announces Programming Grants, from Staff Reports. The Arts Council of Midland held its annual meeting last week, announcing local arts volunteers for 2021, as well as announcing the subgrants for calendar year 2022. The subgrant program, in its 34th year, is a collaborative program the Arts Council does for the City of Midland, regranting hotel-motel taxes the city allocates for local arts programming. Each fall, ACM recognizes local arts volunteers from the community. Those special arts volunteers nominated by local agencies for 2021 included Greg Smith, Arts Council of Midland, Easton Guevara, based in PBS, Sue Robertson and Nancy Kirk, Midland Palette Club, Melissa Wicker, Midland Festival Ballet, Althea Bischke, Midland Community Theater, Allison Pace, Midland Quilters Guild, and Marlon Butler, Wagner Noel Performing Arts Center. From this group of generous and talented individuals, Butler was chosen Midland's Arts Volunteer of the Year. The Arts Council has collaborated with the City of Midland for 34 years by distributing arts programming grants to Midland groups. For 2022, $112,500 in subgrants will be granted to the following organizations. Basin PBS, Main Street Unplugged, 2022, $3,000. Hispanic Cultural Center of Midland, Ballet Folklorico, $5,000. Mariachi Program, $5,000. Cinco de Mayo, 2022, $2,500. And Nueva Generacion Mariachi, $7,000. Live on Stage, 2022 Concert Series, $8,000. MARC, Music Therapy Intern Project, $2,500. Midland African American Roots Historical Cultural Arts Council, Inc., Dallas Black Dance Theater, $7,000. Midland Community Theater, 2022 Theater Season, $14,500. Midland Festival Ballet, 2022 Season Productions, The Nutcracker and Aladdin, $25,000. Midland Odessa Symphony and Chorale, Educational Outreach at WNPAC, $5,000. Spring 2022 Concerts, $12,000. Midland Palette Club, 8 art demonstrations, 1 workshop, and 1 outreach program, $3,000. Midland Quilters Guild, 2022, Biennial Quilt Show, $6,000. Permian Basin Bookies, Inc., Permian Basin Writers Workshop, $5,000. Permian Basin Opera, Glory Denied, $3,000. West Texas Jazz Society, Jazz for Middle School at WNPAC, $4,000. Arts Council of Midland also reported that its 2021 President's Award, the Flying Monkey, went to Carl Rundgren. Celebration of the Arts volunteer Barbara Murphy also was honored. Arts Council of Midland, located at 1506 West Illinois Avenue, is open from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday to Friday or by appointment. For more information, contact acmidland.org, call 687-1149, or email events@acmidland.org or info@acmidland.org. This is the region and state page. This article is entitled Collier Makes Second Try for Lieutenant Governor. Associated Press. Austin. Democrat Mike Collier on Monday formally announced a second try for Texas Lieutenant Governor in a race that now also includes former Bush campaign strategist Matthew Dowd. Collier, an accountant who lost to Republican Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick by 4.8 percentage points in 2018, made his entry official months after forming an exploratory campaign, although he had made clear that he intended to make another run. Collier said he has raised more than $1 million so far, and both he and Dowd are starting off without going on the attack against each other. It is Collier's third bid for statewide office after also running for controller in 2014. Dowd, the one-time chief strategist to Republican President George W. Bush's 2004 re-election campaign, announced in September that he will run for lieutenant governor as a Democrat. Democrats are still waiting for a candidate for governor, although former Congressman Beto O'Rourke has said he is considering a run. No Democrat has won a statewide office in Texas since 1994. This article is entitled, "Emails Show Ector County Judge Unreceptive to Hospital," by Matt Stringer, Odessa Headlines. In August, officials with Medical Center Hospital in Odessa made a plea for help to both the City of Odessa and the Ector County Commissioners, asking for financial assistance due to the increased costs of treating COVID-19 patients during the latest surge. City officials responded quickly to the ask, inviting hospital officials before the council to state their case, and soon thereafter approved millions in support that went to hire additional nurses and staffs. Ector County's response, however, has been significantly different. The hospital made their pitch for aid to the city and county due to the fact both had received a significant amount of funding from the federal government through the American Rescue Act, with Ector County receiving the first of two $16 million payments, $32 million total, with the second payment set to arrive in the spring of 2022. In addition, the hospital says they have figured out how both entities can get reimbursed by the federal government for any money they give to the hospital, which will essentially result in doubling the funding to the benefit of Ector County residents. Ector County officials were quick to use a portion of the money to help pay for the increased costs the county experienced due to the pandemic, incorporating $4.5 million into their budget. But with nearly 2 months having elapsed since the hospital made the original request to be considered for funding, county officials have largely been silent on the issue, except to question the hospital's need of the funding, and then taking the unusual step of voting unanimously on September 27th to hire a consultant firm to vet and audit applications for funding, including the hospital. The consultant would then issue a recommendation to the county on how to approve the funds. Ector County Judge Debbie Hayes is reported saying after the vote to hire the veteran consultant that while she isn't for or against giving funding to the hospital, quote, "at some point through the normal process, the question has to be asked, how much money do you need?" Unquote. Emails obtained by Odessa Headlines via public records requests have revealed that the judge has actually denied the hospital the opportunity to fully explain to them through the normal process what the needs of the hospital are. In an email from MCH CEO Russell Tippin to Judge Hayes dated August 12th, Tippin asked Hayes to add three items on the agenda for the August 24th Commissioner's Court meeting, which would have allowed Tippin sufficient time to explain to the county all the details surrounding their request for funding to hire critical care nurses, purchase additional ventilators, and other expenses relating to COVID-19. All told, Tippin requested $6.5 million from the county. Judge Hayes did not respond to Tippin for nearly a week, prompting Tippin to email the judge once more, writing, "Judge, is there any update on this request? Did this get approved for the agenda? Just wondering." Judge Hayes finally responded to Tippin later that day, writing in a single sentence, "MCH will have the opportunity at the Commissioner's Court meeting to request the needs of the hospital." However, when the August 24th Commissioner's Court agenda was released, none of the items Tippin requested were listed, and Tippin did not get much of an opportunity. Instead, the judge added a single all-encompassing agenda item relating to the American Rescue Act funds and the COVID-19 pandemic, and placed Tippin in line with eight other entities, including two county departments, all asking the commissioners for a portion of the federal funds and limited time to address the court to 3 minutes each. The lack of willingness to communicate with the hospital, coupled with the county judge denying the hospital the opportunity to come to fully explain their need before the court, has drawn ire and anger from hospital officials who say if the judge doesn't know what the hospital's needs are, it is because she is working hard not to know. To give an analogy, it's like someone plugged their fingers in their ears and said, "I can't hear you. Talk to my consultant." All the while, lives are at stake, Ector County Hospital Board President Bryn Dodd said in a statement. It is unknown how long it will take the county to hire a vetting consultant and how long it will take the consultant to review the hospital's application. It also remains to be seen how much the consultant will cost Ector County taxpayers. This is the Business and Oil page. This article is entitled OPEC Plus's Stay the Course Approach Alarms Febrile Oil, by Grant Smith, Salma El Wardani, Javier Blas, and Dina Krenikova, Bloomberg. Prices are surging across febrile global energy markets, but OPEC Plus demonstrated that it's not ready to be diverted from its trajectory of slow and steady oil production increases. After a short meeting on Monday, ministers ratified a 400,000-barrel-a-day supply hike for November. While the cartel was simply sticking to its well-established plan to gradually roll back output cuts, traders reacted with alarm, pushing crude to the highest in almost 7 years in New York. After a relatively quiet summer, oil is now joining natural gas, coal, and a host of other vital commodities in a potent rally that threatens to upend the world's recovery from the coronavirus pandemic by spurring inflation and disrupting industries. The Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and its allies aren't standing idly by while this happens. They already boosted production by almost 2 million barrels a day this year, about 2% of world demand, and have promised to add 400,000 barrels a day each month until September 2022. Yet the incremental approach the cartel agreed to back in July sits increasingly uneasy alongside a spiraling global energy crisis. In governments and central banks of the world's largest economy, there's palpable anxiety about the coming winter. It's not that OPEC Plus does not recognize the coming supply shortage, said Bjornar Tonhagen, head of oil markets at Rystad AS. The group is well aware of the global inventory draws, maintenance work, and rising demand, but chose to wait until later this year to adopt a bolder supply approach. Going into Monday's OPEC Plus talks, there had been speculation that the cartel could opt for a larger supply increase. There was widespread anticipation that it was going to be an 800,000-barrel-a-day temporary boost in November, said Rob Thummel, a portfolio manager at Tortoise, a firm that manages roughly $8 billion in energy-related assets. However, no such proposal was made, OPEC delegates said, asking not to be named because the meeting was private. When it became clear that the group wasn't going to give any extra, West Texas Intermediate crude jumped as much as 3.3% to $78.38 a barrel in New York, the highest since November 2014. Despite the misplaced expectations, the current oil market is looking good for OPEC Plus. Crude is trading at multi-year highs without prompting a surge in rival supplies. Saudi Arabia's oil revenue is the highest since 2018. All this means the kingdom is keen to tweak the current OPEC Plus deal of little monthly increases as little as possible, said Amrita Sen, chief oil analyst and co-founder of Consultant Energy Aspects. Getting every member of the 23-nation coalition to agree to the current output policy was no mean feat. The deal was forged in a series of acrimonious meetings that exposed deep fissures between Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, two of the group's closest allies. That long ordeal was a climax of more than a year of tumult and hardship. from a historic slump triggered by the pandemic to a vicious price war between Russia and Saudi Arabia. Yet, the delicate balance that OPEC Plus has achieved is at risk due to spillover from external crises. The shortage of natural gas, which has sent prices of the fuel to the equivalent of $190 a barrel, is spurring a switch to oil products for heating and manufacturing. That trend could boost overall demand by about 500,000 barrels a day, according to Amin Nasser, chief executive officer of Saudi state oil company Aramco. At the same time, U.S. oil production is still struggling to recover from Hurricane Ida, which has knocked out a total of almost 35 million barrels after slamming the Gulf of Mexico a month ago. That's the equivalent to almost two full months of OPEC Plus supply increases. Goldman Sachs Group Inc. said its base case is for Brent crude to rise as high as $90 a barrel from about $81 currently. Damian Corvalin, the company's head of energy research, said on Bloomberg TV. Oil inventories are about to reach the lowest in 10 years, he said. In this environment, the oil market is looking to OPEC Plus for guidance, but there was no press briefing after the meeting. We anticipated the group would signal prices may have overreacted lately, or that it would indicate crude exports from the Middle East are likely to increase over the coming months, said Giovanni Stanovo, a commodity analyst at UBS Group AG, said in a note. But neither issue was addressed. There's little sign so far of the kind of political pressure that could get the cartel to change course. Before Monday's meeting, Washington told Riyadh it was satisfied with the current pace of OPEC Plus supply hikes, a U.S. official said, asking not to be named because the talks were private. The Americans did make clear that they want the group to remain attentive to the market, particularly any spillover from natural gas, said the official. OPEC Plus have to be careful not to allow prices to inflate too much, said Rystad's Tonhagen. Otherwise, we may see an adverse reaction that could negatively impact post-pandemic economic growth. This is the opinion page. This column is entitled Stand Up Because the Truth is Under Attack by Stuart Doreen, MRT editor. On Sunday, Pro-Life Midland held the annual Life Chain event. Here's hoping it accomplishes everything organizers were hoping for, including bringing attention to destruction of life that occurs every year in our nation. Some may think, since the passage of Senate Bill 8, that pro-life Texans can let the foot off the gas. That shouldn't take place. No matter what happens with the new law and others around the nation attempting to protect the unborn, we need those in the pro-life movement to keep up the intensity, peacefully, of course, just like we need others would have previously thrown in the towel to rejoin the fight. Having written that, I stumbled across an interview on YouTube with Jason Whitlock, a columnist, podcaster, and digital TV host for Blaze Media. He was talking with Tucker Carlson about abortion, alleged racism on the right, and the fight over what is true. Whitlock. Tucker, we're looking at and we're living in an era where the truth is under a level of attack that it has never been under. You have to understand it from a biblical perspective. God is a search for truth. God is truth. The gospel is truth. And it's under attack in this very secular society. And they're very clever and strategic about how they're going about it. The whole defining of truth as offensive in this whole little safe space society we built, where everybody lives in fear of saying anything that someone can define as offensive, is an attack on truth. Because the truth, particularly biblical truth in this area, is probably offensive and will make people uncomfortable. But we're creating a society where we want to make sure anything that comes out of our mouth doesn't make any single person on the planet uncomfortable. Therefore, it is impossible to get to the truth. Strategy number two, which is just as effective, or perhaps the most effective, is they frame. The left has, and the Democratic Party has framed, every argument in racial terms, and they control the racial conversation in this country. If they say abortion is freedom, abortion is an extension of white supremacy, even though the truth and the facts say 40% of the abortions in America are happening to black women, and we're killing about 650 black babies per day here in America through abortion. Abortion, if it is an extension of white supremacy, it's because it's executing a genocide on black babies. The protection of abortion rights is in no way protecting black people. But the Democratic Party has just been so clever in its assault on the truth, and it's its silencing of truth and anybody that speaks against it. I just got to tip my hat to them because this is a propaganda campaign the likes of which I'm not sure we've ever seen in the history of the planet. And it's effective. And if men and women don't stand up, and those of us that believe in the truth, those of us that believe in the founding principles of this country, if we don't stand up, they're going to continue to slaughter us with lies framed as truth. Tucker, if you love someone, wouldn't you encourage them to have kids to reproduce and to be fruitful and multiply? Whitlock, you certainly would if you want them to experience the highest level of joy that life has to offer. And I think that it is, having, raising, and developing young kids. Obviously, family is at the root of all successful societies. We are destroying that under a barrage of lies. Tucker, as a black man, a proud black man in this country, I'm so offended that we as black people are being used by the left political machine in an attempt to grab power. They're using our previous pain and discrimination to bring us down, and this entire nation down. And I'm just begging those of us who are believers, and those of us with any common sense, we must call this unbelievable racism that we're seeing from the left. We must call it out. We must stand up against it, call it exactly what it is. If there's anybody imitating Hitler and Margaret Sanger, it is the left. They're trying to destroy this country, and they're doing it by destroying black people first, and then using race and the religion of race that they've replaced Christianity and the Judeo-Christian values that made this country great. It was our pursuit of the approval of God that many in this country accomplish great things. Now we're all begging to be on the right side of some racial history that the left is going to write. On Saturday, my pastor reminded me that good work reflects the character of God. There is still good work to be accomplished, especially with some wanting to hijack what is right and what is truth. When we speak about what we know to be truth, we shouldn't worry about offending, just like there are others who don't worry about offending believers. Be respectful and treat one another as you would want to be treated. But don't sit there as the truth is being rewritten before our very eyes. This is the obituary column, Tuesday, October 5th. Mary Eloise Carter. Mary Eloise Carter was called home by her Savior on October 1st. Eloise Carter was born November 26, 1931, in Childress, Texas, to Hazel and Clennon Williams. Eloise was preceded in death by her husband of 58 years, Jimmy Carter, her brother Dan Williams, and sister Janice Bell. She is survived by her sister, Barbara Berth of Heber Springs, Arkansas, sister-in-law Dorothy Carter of Big Spring, daughter Diane Moore, son Steve Carter, and son Tim Carter, and his wife Laura, all of Midland. Also surviving Mary Lou Eloise are her five grandchildren and seven great-grandchildren. Funeral services will include an intimate graveside service at Rest Haven Memorial Park, Wednesday, October 6th at 1 p.m. Viewing will be available Tuesday after 12 p.m. and early Wednesday at Nellie Picklin Welch Funeral Home in Midland, prior to the graveside service at Rest Haven. If preferred, in lieu of flowers, donations may be made to Hospice of Midland, 911 West Texas Avenue, Midland, 79701. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Picklin Welch Funeral Home and Crematory. Raul Valenzuela. Raul Valenzuela, 89, of Midland, passed away on Saturday, October 2nd. A viewing will be held from 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. Tuesday, October 5th, at the branch at NPW. Rosary will be held at 7 p.m. Wednesday, October 6th, at the branch at NPW. Funeral Mass will be held at 10 a.m. Thursday, October 7th, at San Miguel Catholic Church. Burial will follow at Serenity Memorial Gardens. Raul was born on January 3, 1932, in Potrero Delano, Chihuahua, Mexico, to Luisa and Dario Valenzuela. Raul is survived by his wife Maria, his children Rosendo and wife Isabel, Edmundo and wife Janie, Badilio and wife Michelle, Olivia and husband Martin Dominguez, and Jose Luis and wife Lorena, and numerous grandkids, great-grandkids, nieces and nephews. Raul is preceded in death by his daughter Maria Luisa Carrasco, his brother Ramon Valenzuela, his sisters Elba Arroya, Ima Tavares, and Pilar Valenzuela, his grandsons Rudy Valenzuela and Stephen Carrasco. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Picklin Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Death notices. Eladio Sanchez Caballero. Eladio Sanchez Caballero, 64, of Midland, passed away Monday, October 4th. Viewing will be Wednesday, October 6th, from 10 a.m. to 9 p.m., with a prayer service at 7 p.m. Wednesday evening at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home Chapel. Funeral service is set for Thursday, October 7th, at 2 p.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Chapel. Burial will follow at Serenity Memorial Gardens. Tilly Womble. Tilly Womble, 83, of Midland, passed away October 1st. Graveside service will be held Friday, October 8th at 1 p.m. at Fairview Cemetery in Midland. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Picklin Welch Funeral Home. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. Travé Monique Jackson. Travé Monique Jackson, 28, of Midland, passed away Monday, September 27th. Visitation will be Thursday, October 7th, from 10 a.m. to 9 p.m., and Friday, October 8th, from 10 a.m. to 9 p.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home. A funeral service is set for Saturday, October 9th, at 11 a.m. at Greater Ideal Baptist Church, 411 South Tyler Street. Victor M. Robles. Victor M. Robles, 77, passed away surrounded by his loving family on September 26th in Greeley, Colorado. Victor was born March 6, 1944, in Seguin, Texas, to Felix and Matilda Robles, Jr. A viewing will be held from 1 to 9 p.m. Sunday, at October 3rd, at Stanton Memorial Funeral Chapel. A rosary will be recited at 7 p.m. Funeral Mass will be held 10 a.m. Monday, October 4th, at St. Joseph Catholic Church. Interment will follow at Evergreen Cemetery. Victor leaves to cherish his loving memory, his wife, Augustina H. Robles, daughters, Elia Robles, Mary Linda Ritter, Ada Robles, sons, Victor R. Robles, Benita Joe Robles, four sisters, three brothers, 15 grandchildren, 15 great-grandchildren, and one great-great-grandchild. Funeral arrangements are entrusted to Stanton Memorial Funeral Home. Online condolences can be received at www.stantonfh.com.
Hi, I'm Kim, reading the Odessa American. It is Tuesday, October 5th, 2021. City to consider tighter restrictions for game rooms. The Odessa City Council will consider several measures to clamp down on the proliferation of game rooms, including limiting hours of operation and locations where they can operate. Council will consider the proposed ordinance changes during their work session. Along with police department, we're making these recommendations because game rooms are not even addressed in our zoning ordinance. Planning Director Randy Brindley said, many of these places run 24 hours a day. There's no regulations. Under the proposed amendment, changes to game room hours of operation would be limited to 8 a.m. to 11 p.m. Monday through Thursday and 8 a.m. to midnight Friday through Sunday. Several residents earlier this year cited the growing number of game rooms in Odessa as a major concern during a town hall meeting with Mayor Javier Jovan. At the time, Jovan promised residents that he would work with the city's legal department and administrators to address their concerns. Jovan could not be reached for further comment on Monday. The revamped ordinance would prohibit game rooms from being located within 1,000 feet of another gaming establishment, church, educational institution, healthcare facilities, public building, or the boundary lines of a residential zoning district, Brindley said. An exemption will be granted to any gaming operation that can offer proof that the business has operated at the same site and under the same name and ownership prior to December 1, 2021, according to the proposed amendment changes. New game rooms will only be considered in areas already zoned light industrial and heavy industrial districts. The businesses will also be required to have 30 paved parking spaces plus one space for every 100 square feet of floor area over 2,000 square feet. UTEP musicians put PHS musicians through paces. Musicians, clinicians, and Professor Jim Logan offered some tips to Permian High School Woodwinds musicians Monday to help them prepare for their upcoming region auditions. The tryouts are in December. Logan told about 12 students what the judges will be listening for and advised them to take their time to get set anytime they are playing something. Several of the students had previously gone through the audition process, but they appreciated the help. I thought it was incredibly helpful, and I am very excited to work with him later today, 17-year-old junior clarinetist Grace Sanchez said. I thought he offered incredible tips that not a lot of other clinicians do. Alicia Clear, a 17-year-old senior clarinet player, thought the class was pretty cool. We hardly ever get clarinetists to help us, so it was a really good thing that he came here. I'm going to take advantage of that and go and work with him more, Clear said. Logan was going to stay through Monday and possibly into Tuesday to help the musicians. She said the lessons will make her feel more comfortable about the upcoming tryouts. Because of marching, we aren't able to practice much on region, so this helps a lot, Clear said. Logan is from Iowa, but he lived in Odessa 30 years ago for 3 years. He is currently a clarinet professor at University of Texas at El Paso. I came to town as the principal clarinetist in the Midland Odessa Symphony, and it was a dual position. The principal clarinetist in that symphony taught lessons in the 6 junior highs and 2 high schools, Logan recalled. He taught 60 to 65 half-hour lessons a week, in addition to playing in the orchestra and playing in a woodwind quintet. It was a great learning experience. That was really hard work, but I really learned a lot about clarinet and teaching on that, Logan added. He also has performed with the U.S. Navy Band, among many other orchestras and bands. Logan has been playing the clarinet since 5th grade. I chose it. We had band night, and it was just the instrument I was drawn to, Logan said. He added that he conducts clinics as much as he can. UTEP encourages community outreach, and for 3 years, I've been in El Paso, and I've focused all of my time in El Paso because it's a massive city, But since the first day I was in El Paso, I've been determined to get back to Odessa for a lot of reasons, Logan said. One was that he wanted to say thank you to Odessa. He said the experience was stressful, but it helped him as a teacher. Lindsay Even, an associate director of the Permian High School Band, said having Logan on hand Monday was fantastic. I think it's a really great opportunity for the kids to be able to be exposed to these wonderful teachers. And also, just to get a face in front of them that's not just us all the time, and just to kind of get a different perspective. These teachers, they teach all over the state of Texas, and they get to see some really wonderful bands. And so they get to bring that perspective to the kids here in West Texas, because our kids are often sort of removed from those other programs like Dallas, Austin, and Houston. They don't get to see these bands very often at all, and so these teachers get to bring a little piece of that to these kids and hopefully get them a little more competitive and up to that level. Many of those larger city schools are incredible. They have lots of resources, things that we don't necessarily have here in Midland, Odessa. So we're certainly extremely grateful that they get to come and work with our kids today, Even said. Ultimately, the process leads to statewide competition. It's a process that starts in July, and it goes all the way until early January. So it's about 6 months, about half the year, Even said. Even also is a Permian High School graduate and flautist who made it to the state level. She earned her bachelor's and master's in flute performance from West Texas A&M University and her doctorate in flute performance from the Cincinnati Conservatory of Music. Even was gone for almost a decade for school, but wanted to come back to be closer to family. Richard Lambrick, also from UTEP, was helpful with the horn players. They had arranged to go to Permian High School separately, but wound up on the same day. Enrollment surges at OHS. With a total enrollment of 32,026, Ector County ISD has full houses at its comprehensive high schools and middle schools. The elementary campuses are a mixed bag, and new this year is the Odessa YMC Learning Center, which has 135 3- and 4-year-olds. Enrollment at Odessa High School has hit more than 4,000, while Permian High School is at 3,821. Permian has a larger freshman class at 1,303 than Odessa High School, which has 1,136 ninth graders. The number of students in grades 9 through 12 decrease as they go up. There are 1,029 sophomores at OHS, 989 juniors, and 851 seniors. At Permian, there are 971 sophomores, 837 juniors, and 710 seniors. George H.W. New Tech Odessa has hit 442 students in grades 9 through 12. Among the early college high schools, OC Techs has 354 and Odessa Collegiate Academy has 374 students. Odessa High School principal Mauricio Marquez said this year is one of the largest enrollments the campus has had in several years. It has been great to see all the students back on campus after going through hybrid and remote learning last year. Students need to be back in school, not only for their education, but also for their social and emotional needs. Our teachers, administrators, and staff have enjoyed having our students back this year, Marquez said in an email. At the same time, Marquez acknowledged that Odessa High School is over capacity. We currently have 14 portables and have 17 teachers without classrooms that have to float from classroom to classroom, he said. As the grades go up from 9th grade, the class size declines. There are various reasons for the larger number of students in 9th grade. One of the key factors is due to students not obtaining the necessary credits to be considered sophomores, juniors, or seniors. Unfortunately, some of these students that did not earn their credits are due to excessive absences. The state of Texas requires students to be in attendance 90% in order to receive their credits. We also have students who, unfortunately, leave school to pursue a job in the oil and gas industry, which impacts these numbers and our dropout rate, Marquez said. He added that there are many things they do to support the students in ninth grade and beyond. Our district has implemented a transition plan for ninth grade students. This year, they are given 2 days on campus prior to having the sophomores, juniors, and seniors attend. The purpose for this transition plan was to ensure that our ninth grade students were made to feel welcome, because it can be overwhelming for any middle school student to come from a campus of approximately 1,000 students to a large comprehensive high school with 4,000 students. We divided the entire ninth grade class into smaller groups and held presentations throughout the campus to allow the students to become familiar with the campus. We also utilized these 2 days to provide orientations to all ninth grade students regarding the importance of grades, attendance, and taking advantage of all of the courses that we have to offer, he wrote. Our counselors and administrators conducted presentations on the opportunities of taking advanced classes in advanced placement, international baccalaureate, dual credit, and on-ramps, which is an amazing opportunity for students to obtain college credit while still in high school. They also presented all of the great opportunities that we offer through our career and technical education programs, he added. We continue to provide ongoing support to all of our students throughout the year. It is imperative that our students get involved in some aspect of our school, whether it's athletics, fine arts, CTE, academics, or one of our many student clubs. Students need to feel connected to our school, Marquez said. Ultimately, he said, it's about creating relationships with every student. It's our charge and responsibility to ensure that every student is made to feel welcome and supported, Marquez wrote. Nimitz Middle School tops the middle school enrollment with 1,433 students. Ector College Prep Success Academy, an in-district charter school, has 1,369 students. Wilson and Young Medal of Honor Middle School has 1,257 students. Bonham Middle School has 987 students. Bowie has 1,024, and Crockett Middle School has 995. Among the elementary schools, Fly has the largest enrollment at 948. Buse has 842 students. Jordan has 778. West has 637. And Cavazos has 669 as examples. Reagan Elementary has 607 students, and Hayes has 410. Ross has among the smallest enrollment at 375. Travis has 292, but it has only grades 3 through 5. Zavala has 398 students in pre-kindergarten through second grade. Carver Early Education Center has 303 students, and Lamar Early Education Center has 441. COVID-19 news by the numbers. COVID in the basin. Ector County, 24,998 total cases, 490 deaths. Midland County, 26,831 total cases, 342 deaths. Texas, 4,084,361 total cases, 65,914 deaths. U.S. cases, 43,605,623 total confirmed and 700,176 deaths. Find out more at covidinthebasin.com or the CDC site at tinyurl.com/TZTRJLF. See the ECISD COVID-19 dashboard at tinyurl.com/Y6NTPTQQ. MCH COVID numbers. Medical Center Hospital daily COVID inpatient numbers as of 8:30 a.m. Monday. 49 total COVID patients in-house. Med-surg non-critical, 28 COVID patients. 25 unvaccinated, 1 vaccinated, 2 unknown, includes 1 on pediatrics. Critical care, 21 COVID patients, 15 on ventilators. 13 unvaccinated, 5 vaccinated, 3 unknown. Of the 15 COVID patients on ventilators, 5 are vaccinated, 9 are unvaccinated, 1 unknown. Age ranges of COVID patients, 15 through 93 years old. Patients from outside Ector County include 1 from Crane, 2 from Fort Stockton, 1 from Jal, New Mexico, 3 from Midland, 1 from Presidio. The rest are from Odessa, Ector County. Quick hits, Taste of the Permian Basin. The 37th annual Taste of the Permian Basin has been scheduled for Thursday at the Bush Convention Center, 105 North Main Street, Midland. Sponsor preview parties will take place from 5:30 p.m. to 6:30 p.m. General admission is from 6:30 to 8 p.m., $40 in advance, or $50 at the door. Featured vendors, Barn Door Steakhouse, 10 Sports Bar and Grill, Coca-Cola, Culligan of West Texas, Ducote Coffee Company, ECISD Culinary Arts, Gerardo's Casita, Johnny's Barbecue Midland, La Margarita, MISD Culinary Arts, Mulberry Cafe, Ranchland Hills, Rockin' Q Smokehouse, Rose's Cafe and Tortilla Factory, Taco Villa, and more to be added. For the comfort and convenience of all attendees, no strollers or carriers will be permitted. To sponsor, visit tinyurl.com/3WP9RD6D. For more information, visit tastethepermianbasin.com or 432-563-5233.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.